from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jared Diamond, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, says it's time to take a sober look at what traditional societies have to offer the modern world. Very traditional societies, the kinds with loincloths and spears and older than ancient ideas about how to live, to survive. Jared Diamond has given a lot of us lessons in geography and resources. Now he's looking at the oldest human ways of living. This hour on Point, Jared Diamond on life lessons from the world's most traditional societies. Joining me now from Culver City, California is Jared Diamond, professor of geography at UCLA, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, Why is Sex Fun and Collapse? His new book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Jared Diamond, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's nice to be back with you, Tom.
Yesterday sounds like 24 hours ago. What do you mean by the world until yesterday?
The world until yesterday is the world for the last 6 million years of human history, and I refer to it as yesterday because it's only a few thousand years ago, which is nothing by comparison with 6 million years, that we first developed things like state government and justice and writing that we now take for granted, but which didn't exist for most of our history, that is, until virtually yesterday.
So a lot of people may be wondering, when you describe that, what we long called primitive societies and their heirs on this earth today. You spend a lot of time in New Guinea. We'll look at that. They may be wondering if you're sort of putting that forward as a Garden of Eden, you know, just wrap on a loincloth and grab a blow dart and, pound some tapioca and you're good.
Good point, Todd. The fact is that, yes, we swing between those two extremes in looking at traditional societies. On the one hand, some of us idealize and romanticize them and think, oh, if we could only put on a loincloth and be peaceful and in harmony with nature. Other people regard traditional peoples as barbarian, primitive, best quickly exterminated or pushed out of the way or dragged into the modern world. The fact is, they're people. They're people dealing with the same problems of rearing children and growing older and staying healthy as we do, but they've been doing it for tens of thousands of years. They've carried out all these natural experiments that we can learn from.
You're not talking archaeology here. You're talking lived experience, your own, among such people. Well, go to New Guinea again, but when you look at the whole planet, what percentage of the global population fits your definition of traditional or what we long called primitive? I don't know if you're rejecting that word. What percentage of the world's population now falls in that category?
If by traditional or so-called primitive, you are thinking of hunter-gatherers outside the control of civilization, a tiny fraction of a percent, a small number of tribes in New Guinea and more tribes scattered throughout the Amazon. On the other hand, there are millions of people who until recently were living traditionally with stone tools and loincloths in New Guinea, in the Amazon, and in Africa. And the fact is that here in the United States, in rural areas of the U.S., such as western Massachusetts or Montana, where we spend our vacations, in those rural areas, there's still a lot of traditional living going on. For example, if you have an argument with your neighbor, you don't call in the police or sue, get a lawyer, but you settle the dispute in a traditional way face to face. So there still is much traditional society in the world today throughout the United States and elsewhere.
I'm trying to stretch my mind from the rainforest of New Guinea to western Massachusetts, and I'm having a little difficulty, but we'll come to that. Your own experience, very deep in New Guinea, you've been going for years and years. Describe that experience for us.
I've been going to New Guinea for nearly 50 years now to study birds. New Guinea has the world's most wonderful birds and huge expanses of undisturbed rainforest. Mm-hmm. But to do anything in New Guinea, you have to be with New Guineans. I depend on New Guineans to show me trails and give me permission to be on their land and light fires. And so I'm always chatting with New Guineans. They're wonderful people. I've learned a lot from them. In some ways, they're very similar to me. They're scared. They're happy. They cry at the same time that I do. And on the other hand, they're different in basic respects such as friendship and how they pick their spouses and their attitudes towards danger. So I love being with them, and I've learned a lot from them.
So your big message, we're going to dive into the details. Your big message from this book is what? That we I mean, we like to see ourselves as the successors to these societies you're talking about, but you're saying look back, and there may still be vivid things that we need to take from them now, or things that we need to avoid, both?
Both. There are things in traditional societies that are terrible, to which we say, thank God we're through with that. For example, killing weak babies, sometimes abandoning or killing old people, having uninterrupted wars, thank God we're through with that. On the other hand, the way that they, many ways in which they raise their children and often how they treat their old people and how they never, never get diabetes or heart disease or stroke and how they settle disputes in a way that's satisfying. Those are things that we can learn from because we face those same problems and we often make a mess of them.
So take us in. Maybe let's start at the beginning of life with child rearing. You've had a very interesting conversation in your book, discussion of child rearing in this traditional, very traditional kind of society versus modern child rearing. Give us a contrast.
There are lots of differences. To take a simple one, we often transport our babies by pushing them in a baby carriage, which means that they're horizontal and not looking where they're going. Mm-hmm. Or if we carry them in a backpack, they may be facing backwards. Traditional societies always carry their babies vertically, facing forwards, so the baby sees where it's going.
Kind of right there on your hip.
That's right, either mm-hmm. on your hip or on your back or in a shoulder mm-hmm. pack. Mm-hmm. That's a simple thing. Mm-hmm. Another simple thing is that hunter-gatherers never, never spank or smack their children.
Really?
Another thing is that they leave their children a lot of freedom to decide what they want, and the result is that I and everybody else who's worked with traditional societies, we're impressed by how socially assured and independent and self-confident and happy these kids are and grow up to be.
Take just the view of the baby from mother or father's shoulder, the fact that they're vertical and looking forward, kind of seeing whatever the grown-up with them is seeing. So what? What's it mean?
Well, we don't have a controlled experiment to prove what it means, but what's observed is that kids in these traditional societies develop advanced neuromotor skills. They may start to walk earlier or they're more self-assured while they're walking. And one may speculate that this is because they've grown up as babies looking forward and seeing what the mother or person carrying them sees, and their bodies are in synchrony with where they're going, rather than our modern babies in prams being carried backwards, totally out of control, and having no sense of where they're going.
When you're hanging out in California versus somewhere in the upcountry in New Guinea, then do you see people moving differently? Do they seem more adept just in their physical interaction with the world, or do we overcome that with years of soccer practice and everything else?
Eventually, of course, we catch up with our physical skills. The big differences are with respect to social skills. I'm impressed, my friends are impressed by how socially skilled these kids in traditional societies become. At the age of 5 or 8, they're confident dealing with adults. I remember an occasion my first year in New Guinea when I needed some porters in a village, and there was a 10-year-old kid who volunteered to be a porter. He didn't ask his parents. His parents weren't around. He just joined me as a porter for a week, went off, stayed with me for a month. Somebody told his parents that their son had gone off with the white man, who knows where, would eventually come back. But in New Guinea, it's taken for granted that a 10-year-old or even a 5-year-old kid is going to be capable of making his or her own decisions.
That would be a complete freak out in this country, right? Call the cops.
It seems like a freak out, but on the other hand, it's something that my wife and I adopted in rearing our own kids. We let our own kids make their choices insofar as was safe, and there were some surprising outcomes. For example, my son Max, at the age of 3, fell in love with snakes. And all right, my wife and I are not snake lovers, but we let Max collect his snakes, and eventually he had as pets 147 snakes, frogs, lizards. He went through a snake phase, and eventually he became a gourmet cook, but those were his choices.
I'm not sure that you're going to be wooing lots of parents onto this path with 147 snakes and frogs in the child's bedroom. I guess it,
we come to these things at different ages. But I guess in some ways the question is what we end up with. Do we end up with better societies? If you say, well, they let the kids play with knives and run around, do what they will, do we end up with a better society?
Again, we don't have numbers and controlled experiments to prove it, but all of us who've worked in New Guinea and the Amazon and Africa, we're struck by the social richness of their lives, that the people end up never lonely. Loneliness is unknown. They're talking constantly with each other. They're curious. They're asking questions. A friend of mine who works in Africa summed it up by saying, African villages have a materially poorer life, but a socially richer life than us Americans.
Jared Diamond, wonderful to have you with us. The new book is The World Until Yesterday, behind us from the Voices of the Rainforest recording. People in the Southern Highlands province of Papua New Guinea, the Kaluli people there. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about survival lessons, life lessons from the world's most unmodern cultures with Jared Diamond, author of Guns, Germs, and Steel. His new book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? You know, Jared, we played that tape out there from that last segment, and I can imagine people listening to you and nodding and saying yes, yes, and then listening to that. And it can sound like something so distant, so, again, this word primitive or traditional, that they may well say, oh, can we really relate to these people? Our experiences of this earth are so different. What do you say to that reaction?
Well, let's take that tape. The tape was music. Mm-hmm. Yes, their music is different from our music, but we still have music.
Sure.
So music is something universal, although the forms are different. To take a really banal example, dangers. All humans encounter dangers.
Yeah.
New Guineans encounter dangers. We encounter dangers. The dangers are different, but I've learned a lot from New Guineans' attitude towards danger.
Well, give us a sense of that. We seem to be surrounded by danger warnings in our media age. Give us a comparison of their assessment of danger versus ours.
Here's an example. I recently did the most dangerous thing that I will today, and I'm going to do this same thing every day, hopefully for the next 30 years of my life. That's to say, I took a shower.
You're a wild and crazy guy, Jared Diamond.
Yeah, really wild and crazy. The fact is, if you read the obituary columns of the newspapers, why people are dying is that one of the big hazards of old Americans is slipping and falling, breaking their hips and killing themselves and or ending the quality of life. Well, from New Guineans, I've learned to be really attentive to these banal everyday events, that each time you do them, the chances are only 1 in 1,000 that you come to grief. But if you intend to repeat them more than 1,000 times in your life, and I sure hope to take more than 1,000 showers in the rest of my life, if you're not really careful, they'll catch up with you, and you can read about that in our obituary columns.
Well, let's
look
at that.
I've learned that from New Guinea.
Yeah, you say pay attention to the dangers right around oneself, and I well understand that. Nobody wants to fall and crack their skull or break their hip or whatever it might be. On the other hand, a lot of these cultures that you're talking about have just sort of disappeared in the last 100 years. You might say that because they didn't look up and see giant dangers coming at them, their cultures as they've known them are going away.
That's a key point, Tom, and the reason that traditional cultures have disappeared is not that they didn't recognize dangers or that they didn't have good ways of bringing up children or taking care of their old people. The reasons that they've disappeared have been very specific, namely that they did not develop guns, germs, and steel, the ingredients of Western power and technology, which depended in turn on the origins of agriculture. So Americans and British and French have conquered peoples around the world, not because we had better ways of bringing up children or recognizing danger, but simply because we had the guns, germs, and steel, and they didn't.
Let's go to Clay in Norfolk, Virginia. Clay, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Jared Diamond.
Yeah, hi, Tom, and hi, Mr. Diamond. How are you guys doing today?
Very well, thanks. Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you both. My question for Mr. Diamond is related, and I think it's maybe a follow-up to what a previous caller just asked, and it is related to danger. I'll make it quick, but my background is that after a combat tour in Iraq and a combat tour in Afghanistan, where I was faced with immediate, not indirect or potential, but immediate and real danger,
yeah,
frequently, I came back, like a lot of veterans, with a feeling of, or I would say a different awareness of danger, maybe a respect for it, that I felt a lot of my family members, associates, peers, and in general, maybe our modern culture has. So my question for Mr. Diamond, which I can take off the air, is how perception and awareness and respect and preparation for danger differs between traditional societies and cultures and our modern society, and maybe a comment or his observances on the accuracy, the veracity of us feeling really insulated and protected when maybe we aren't.
Hey, Clay, if I may impose and ask you to stick with us while he thinks about that? Because I'd like to come back to you if you'd be kind enough, Clay. Can you hang on a second?
Absolutely. I appreciate the time.
Sure. Good. Jared Diamond, okay, here you've got a returning U.S. combat vet from Iraq and Afghanistan. He developed a different sense of the awareness of danger, a different interaction with it there. Just take that on to begin with. Are you looking at these very traditional societies and finding people who might have are you talking about a kind of a soldier's combat awareness of danger or something else?
Clay, that's a great question. And the essence of what you're saying is that in Iraq and Afghanistan, you were in situations where mistakes had consequences for you very likely and quickly. In New Guinea, also, mistakes have consequences because there aren't doctors. If you're out on a trail and you slip or if you break a finger, you're going to have a bent finger for the rest of your life. Whereas for us American civilians, you make a mistake and usually you can get it fixed in the hospital. But the fact is that we Americans, civilians too, make mistakes. And if we do things often enough, they eventually catch up with us. So you, Clay, have learned the basic lessons in New Guinea of being very attentive to dangers. We American civilians have not learned that lessons, but nevertheless, we eventually suffer the consequences.
But I would say, and I wonder, Clay, what you think of this. I mean, part of what we describe as civilization is the attempt to build societies where there is less imminent danger. Of course, you can always slip in the shower, but isn't that part of what the project of the last 10,000 years is to, you know, say, well, we've got a different kind of society here. Well, you don't have to constantly be worried about a snake or a sniper.
Good point. Yeah. We don't have to worry about snakes, and we civilians don't have to worry about snipers. Instead, we should worry about other things, and we Americans don't think clearly about danger. We obsess about terrorists and nuclear radiation and chemicals, which realistically are going to kill very few of us, although when they do, it's spectacular. But we don't recognize that the big dangers in life are car accidents, falling off stepladders, consequences of being drunk. So we don't recognize these dangers, and we ignore the fact that we're going to live long enough that they will eventually catch up with us and ruin our lives unless we're attentive to them, as are New Guineans and as Clay learned to be in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Clay, it's an interesting question. You know, some people come back from combat and are haunted by a sense of danger. We call it PTSD sometimes. You say, you know, settle down, you're home, everything's fine now. What about that, Clay?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Diamond for looking at this in a way that I hadn't thought of in terms of basic accidents, illnesses, maybe interaction with animals, which traditional societies have to deal with. And I guess that's kind of appropriate that I didn't think about it because, again, you know, I'm part of a modern culture. But so I'd like to thank Mr. Diamond for pointing that out. I hadn't even considered that aspect. As far as the PTSD side of it, I mean, PTSD is a real problem. I would say, and not as a spokesperson for our military,
sure,
to be clear about that just personally, I think our military has done an amazing job at addressing it both reactively and proactively and taking the stigma away from it. However, there's a lot of returning vets, combat vets, that I associate with, that I am, I mean, my peers that I work with every day, I'm not in a unit that I'm the only one who's experienced this.
Sure.
And the vast majority of us kind of agree that it's not so much a feeling of anxiety or unmotivated or unrealistic awareness, that we actually appreciate it, that we actually feel like we might be safer because of it, or better to able to react to, and I'm not talking about any specific threat, mm-hmm. but threats in general.
Just switched on.
I mean, a lot of my peers I've spoken to have not found it to be something that hampers us, but that we do find there to be a strange difference, you know, dichotomy with the rest of the people we interact with who haven't experienced.
Right. Clay, I appreciate your call so much today. Thank you very much for calling in. Jared Diamond, if we can tee right on off of that, I'd like to talk a little bit about war in these older cultures and in ours, and maybe from there to, you know, resolution, conflict resolution, emotions, how all that gets handled. But since Clay called in, let's start with war. You draw quite a distinction between then and now on that front.
Sure. A difference in war is that we in the United States and most people in the world are living under the control of state governments. The government declares war and ends the war. And when the American government, having declared war, ends a war, if there is some hot-headed young American who wants to continue the war, the U.S. government will make sure that he or she does not continue the war. It's different in tribal societies where there's not a centralized government. Because there's not a leader who can say stop fighting or start fighting, it means that wars drag on in endless cycles of revenge, so that paradoxically, traditional societies, despite the fact that they don't have machine guns and assault rifles, there's a much higher chance of dying a violent death in war in a traditional society than in a modern state-level society, although the body counts are relatively low because there are few people. But the flip side of this is that traditional societies have wonderful ways of settling disputes, and it's only when those ways don't work that they go to war. But the ways are things from which we can learn in settling our own disputes.
Well, let's look at some of that dispute resolution. You write about the exercise of justice. And again, this is in what you call traditional society, pre-industrial, low-density societies without state government. Crucial thing right there. You know, to an American ear, that might sound like an impossible situation to have justice or conflict resolution. You know, it sounds like an endless state of nature, state of war, red in tooth and claw.
In fact, there is, of course, traditional conflict resolution because people are people, and if there's a dispute, one attempts to settle the dispute. Traditional people are very good, usually, at settling disputes. They settle it not by bringing in lawyers and judges, but by negotiations, either face-to-face between the parties or more often with negotiators who are selected by the parties. And the goal of traditional dispute resolution is to achieve emotional clearance so that you are not wrought up against that person and you can live in the presence of that person for the rest of your life. Because in traditional societies, they're sedentary. Your neighbors are going to be there for decades and decades. Whereas our justice system does not provide emotional clearance.
How do they do all that? What do they have in their conflict resolution system, if that's the right word, that leads to emotional clearance?
Sure. Good question. What they have is an acknowledgement of feelings, which our justice system does not offer us. That's to say, a person who has suffered harm from someone else, what that person wants even more than making good the loss of the chicken is an acknowledgement that he was hurt or he was wronged. And the other person offers the acknowledgement together with some tangible say sorry, we say in New Guinea. So, for example, the chapter in my book, I think it's chapter 2 about dispute resolution, begins with a terrible incident of a kid who got killed in a traffic accident. And the result, this was in New Guinea, the result was incomprehensible for us Americans. Namely, 5 days later, the parents and relatives of the dead boy sat down together with the employer and the colleagues of the driver who had killed the boy. They cried together. They made speeches. There was an offer of compensation from the employer. And the result was emotional clearance. They were not churned up for the rest of their lives and saddled with angry feelings.
Did they have a chance to express anger or rage with one another, or that wasn't part of it?
It depends upon the situation. In this case, because the boy had clearly made the mistake by darting out onto the road, the father of the boy did not want to express rage at the employer. The father of the boy instead wanted the employer to acknowledge what a terrible loss he, the father, had suffered. And in fact, my friend, who was the employer, at this meal 5 days later, my friend made a talk which he said was the hardest talk of his life because he ended up crying. He said, "I understand what you've gone through because I've got children of my own." And so there was this emotional resolution.
Well, just to sit and be in that pain together, it's not exactly an American courtroom style resolution you're describing. Melissa in Boston is calling. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
What do you think?
I'm calling from sort of the health perspective. I'm a physical therapist, and I work with a huge population of those who sit all day. And it's impossible to think that these sort of more traditional societies are not suffering the same physical issues that I see on a day-to-day basis involving the hip joints and the shoulder joints, just based on the fact that they have to walk and throw spears and some of the other things that your guest has been talking about. And some of the physical issues that I see on a day-to-day basis just involving the habit of our societies and sitting and computer work and driving and some of the things that I imagine were not done in these traditional societies.
So it must mean a different set of issues. Let's look at that. Jared, we've just got a minute before the break here, but begin to pick that up, the sort of physical interaction of life. And there's somebody who knows P.T. well. She's thinking about, you know, a little, I don't know, climbing and throwing and the toll of that over time versus the kind of tolls we have.
Melissa and Tom, yes, you've got it. It's a partly different set of physical issues. Melissa, you are correct that the people in traditional societies, they do have lots of joint problems because they're physically much more vigorous than we do, and so they have arthritis and problems with their joints. What they don't have is diabetes, heart disease, stroke at all. What they don't have is obesity because they look like bodybuilders. They're physically vigorous. They're not sitting in front of their computers, but they're bouncing around all day.
Do they have a result in lifespan that would be a good rule of thumb for judging the success of those lives? Or is that not fair?
Yes, the result of lifespan is that because they don't have doctors, they die of infectious diseases at a much earlier age than we do, age 40 or 50. We've got doctors, so we don't die of the infectious diseases. We instead die of diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and cancer.
Jared Diamond is with us. His new book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? We'll go out of this segment with the sound of a Kaluli woman of Papua New Guinea singing as she scrapes out the pith of a sago palm tree. What can we learn here? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about survival lessons, life lessons, from the world's most unmodern cultures with Jared Diamond, author of Guns, Germs, and Steel. His new book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Charles is calling from Charleston, South Carolina right now. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My wife and I have a 6-year-old daughter, and we have taken to rearing her with something a little unusual, is that we pay a lot of adherence to how primitive cultures do their child rearing. And one of the big things that we found was they all have communal beds. They all have family beds where the mother and the father and the children all sleep in like one big giant
pile
room.
Okay.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Basically. And we found that that has given our daughter some incredible confidence when dealing with, you know, social interactions and things. She doesn't have a lot of fear and anxiety over the unknown or the unseeing And that might, too, be something that, we do deal with other things, but I think the root of it was our understanding that not fearing the boogeyman, not fearing the thing under the bed, the dark shadows.
She never had to feel that because you were there all together.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Jared Diamond, what do you say?
It's been a good thing.
Charles, that's a great point, and one that I discuss in my book about the many differences between child-rearing and traditional societies and modern societies. The example that you mentioned, yes, that's true. There was probably no baby in human history who slept in a separate room or even slept in a separate bed until within the last 10,000 years. In traditional societies, New Guinea and elsewhere, babies sleep with their parents, and the result is what you observed, Charles, namely that babies grow up with a sense of security. It's not the case that they will be in your bed forever. In traditional New Guinea, eventually children want to sleep by themselves or go off and sleep with other children, mm-hmm. but they do gain a sense of security. What Americans immediately say is, but when do we have an opportunity for sex? And the reality is that there are other opportunities for sex. So this is something that many Americans will feel uncomfortable with, but at least you can consider adopting it, and it contributes to child security.
You know, we look, and there can be such a sense of otherness. I mean, are these families or people that you look upon, Jared, knowing them well, and say, wow, they like, maybe like Charles' daughter, they have a greater sense of ease in the world? Or is that too much? Is that us kind of, you know, putting a rosy glow over their life, where you talk about their constructive paranoia that they live with and all the rest?
No, it's not a matter of rosy glow, but yeah, as we were talking before, it's mm-hmm. a mixture of rosy glow and black glow. There are things in their life that when we see them, we think are wonderful. The sense of security that Charles has imparted to his own daughter is routine among New Guineans. The freedom from non-communicable diseases, the clear perception of danger, the much more satisfying lives of older people. That's not a rosy glow, that's reality. And there's also the cruel reality that we were talking about mm-hmm. before of the deaths from infectious disease if you don't have doctors.
And revenge cycles, a war that can take a large percentage if and when it breaks out of people. Lori in Rockport, Massachusetts. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm fascinated by your discussion. Years ago, I read a book called The Continuum Concept. My daughter, my oldest, is 20 now. And I think a lot of the concepts that your guest is talking about are in this book. I'm curious to know if he's, you know, familiar with it and how that this woman's, she's an anthropologist, her writings compare to his experience. And I'm very happy to...
Is it about child rearing, Lori, or what's the subject?
It is. It's very much about child rearing based on some of those same principles of the indigenous culture that she lived with. Some of the principles of giving your child freedom, the tribe that she lived with, kids routinely handled knives, for example. They didn't have fences. They learned where the edge of the cliff was. But allowing children to experience to a limit so that they could learn very early the realities of their surroundings and not constantly be protected from those realities.
Lori,
yes.
Yeah, well, let us pick it up, Jared. Here we are again with this notion of what the kids may pay a price sometimes, but overall, giving them more freedom. You write, as Lori mentions, even with knives and things we think of as dangerous.
Yeah, Lori, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm not familiar with this particular book, The Continuum Concept, but there are other books written by anthropologists about traditional peoples. Yes, it's a frequent observation that kids from an early age are given the opportunity to do things that we would consider dangerous, such as playing with knives or being close to a fire. We Americans might not want to go that far, but we can give our children far more freedom than we have. We micromanage our children. What I found to be possible in bringing up my own kids is that when I was walking on the streets of Beverly Hills with my kids, I didn't walk hand in hand with them. I let them go ahead of me, and I stayed about 10 feet behind. So if there was some problem, I could run up. But they were the leaders. They made their choices. They went there. They did what they wanted, and I was there to bail them out if there was difficulty. So I gave them as much freedom as I thought appropriate, but I did not let them play with knives when they were young.
Beverly Hills, the law of the jungle surely rules there, Jared. Tough society that your kids managed to survive there.
my kids managed to survive in Beverly Hills, and the outcome is that one of my two sons now has a large set of sharp knives because he's a professional cook.
Okay. And he knows how to do it. Jillian writes to us here. She says, I have my master's degree in Africana studies. I've studied in Ghana. I have to say that based on my experience living with the Ghanaians, they certainly have a richer social life than, she says, most Americans do. There was an inherent belief in social responsibility and unity in most Ghanaians I met, she writes. They were giving and hospitable. I felt secure in that society. I want to get your response to that kind of observation about the overall sense of security. If I may, let me get a call first. Conrad in Worcester, Massachusetts. Conrad, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Professor Diamond.
Hi.
I'm a regular listener, Tom, and a first-time caller.
Welcome.
I have lived here in the United States for 27 years, but I was born and grew up in Ghana, which you were just speaking of, up until my mid-30s before coming to the United States.
Okay.
And I have to say that I am very much in agreement with all of what Professor Jared is saying in this book. And, for example, on child care, I noticed that here in America, there is often the problem of mothers, you know, having to figure out how they will be able to afford childcare or have the appropriate and, you know, safe type of childcare place to bring their children to in order to be able to go to work. In Africa, and especially in Ghana, where I live most, I know that this is not usually a problem because, you know, in the family and then in the community at large, there is always somebody, usually an older person or persons who, just come forward and take on the responsibility of helping look after a child or the children as their parents have gone to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have people who make it their responsibility to take care of their older people, such as retired people who cannot work any longer. So even if they don't have a pension or social security benefit, and the like to, you know, provide for them, there is always somebody who provides for people. I also want to mention that in most of these developing countries like Ghana, you have higher rates of unemployment and people's per capita income is far, far below that of the Western world.
Yep.
And yet, you know, people who don't have know that they can always count on the rest of the community to help them out. And those who do have feel an obligation to do it, and they do it. So there's not usually the kind of anxiety and stress and pressure that you feel in Western, you know, society. And the quality of life, as simple as it may be, tends to be more relaxed, you know, more rewarding. Unfortunately, though, what I've also noticed is that in recent times, there is so much, you know, drive in the young to want to copy everything that comes out of the West.
Conrad, you clearly know of what you speak, and I appreciate your call. There's so much there. I want to come back to the quality of life question, if we may, Jared. And thank you, Conrad. But what about this, the role and status of elders in the very traditional societies that you've looked at, Jared? You write a lot about that, and Conrad brings it up here again in the context of child rearing, and you see that, but more as well.
I'm glad this came up. Yeah, we've talked about differences in child rearing, but there are also differences in treatment of the elderly in traditional societies. It can be much worse, and usually it's much better than in our modern society. It's much worse in nomadic societies that have to shift camp, and eventually it comes to a day where the older person is no longer capable of walking. There's then no alternative except to abandon or, in some cases, kill the older person. Mm-hmm. Conversely, though, in sedentary, which means most traditional societies, older people have a far more satisfying life than older people in the United States.
Why?
Frankly, the situation of the elderly is a disaster in the United States because we move, and so older people end up distant from their children, from their lifelong friends. While in New Guinean traditional societies, people are with their lifelong friends and their relatives. They're taken care of. They have a socially satisfying late years of life, and they're valuable, which they're not they're not regarded as valuable in American
society. And not just for child rearing, though that's very important here, but you describe them putting to work the skills they've honed over a lifetime in the tool production, in agriculture.
The reality is that older people still are valuable in modern American society precisely because of the rapid rate of change. Yes, rapid rate of change means that I can't handle computers. I'm good at slide rules, but who cares about slide rules now for multiplying? So in some senses, I'm obsolete. But on the other hand, I remember a world war and my parents remember a depression. When I talk, when I've talked with hedge funds groups, I'm struck by the fact that most of the kids in hedge funds are 25 and 35-year-old whiz kids. They do very well and the hedge fund blossoms for 5 years and then it crashes because they're not old enough to remember different economic circumstances. So the hedge funds that survive are ones where there are a few 50-year-olds or even 60-year-olds who remember what happened 20 years ago, but the whiz kids haven't seen it.
And what about Conrad's observation, Jillian's as well, on anxiety, stress? We have our own sources of those. I would think that, you know, we all know that the world is not perfect paradise. Every society must have anxiety and stress. Can you make a judgment about who has more, moderns or these very traditional folk?
Really, that's a really interesting question, Tom. I have not noticed differences in stress levels between New Guineans and modern Americans. What is different is the sorts of stress. In traditional New Guinea, there was the stress of the fear of warfare. There still is the stress of the social relationships and obligations, having all those friends and relatives who are interconnected, whom you can count on, as Conrad says. Yes, it's wonderful, but it also means that you've got these obligations which provide stress. So, yes, we are often stressed out, but New Guineans are stressed out over other things.
Jan in Sumter, South Carolina. Jan, you're on the air with Jared Diamond.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I first want to say how fascinated I am by this. I just recently finished watching a DVD set that was done, I believe, in the early 2000s and was finished in 2008. And so my question is, what's the current status of these tribes? Have the youth, like in some of the other Amish counties, basically the youth, are they leaving for the Western world or what they see as a better life? And secondly, when you were just talking about stressors, it was mentioned quite a bit in these DVDs in the filming that the tribes believe in something called a swangy, an evil spirit, and that there was a lot of stress among all the tribes in that at any moment in time, anybody could accuse one of them of being a swangy, an evil spirit, and that they could be killed.
Then we'd have trouble. Jen, our time is short. Let me pick both those up. First, after 6 million years, Jared, do we see communities blinking out here in the face of modern encroachment or their own attraction to it? And then there's this whole realm of, you know, the boogeyman, even here.
Yeah, two great questions. Tom, on the first question of the current status of tribes, throughout the world, traditional peoples want things from the modern world. They want steel tools, they want matches, they want umbrellas, they want doctors, they want enough food, they want educational opportunities for their children. So all traditional peoples that have come in contact with the modern world are adopting at least selectively from the modern world. A friend of mine from New Guinea said we should not talk about traditional societies but transitional societies, and that's true. And then Jan's second point about the stress and tribes believing in the evil spirit. That goes back to the point that came up with Conrad. Yes, there is stress. It's stress in traditional societies about fear of evil spirits and fear of warfare and fear of going hungry and fear of your children dying. So there's plenty of stress, but the stresses are different things from what gives us stress.
Will we be able to have this conversation at the end of this century, Jared? Are these communities going away? Will anybody have lived for 50 years with them in the traditional state another 100 years from now?
Tom, these communities are changing. There are still going to be partly traditional societies. We still have Montana and the rural areas of the U.S. and western Massachusetts. So much traditional will survive, but there's a lot that's changing. No society is going to remain entirely traditional, but we can learn from them.
Jared Diamond's new book is The World Until Yesterday. What can we learn from traditional societies? Jared Diamond, thanks very much for being with us today. Wonderful to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
We'll go out with the sound of a Kaluba song ceremony in Papua New Guinea. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.